is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. Following program was homecrafted and recorded on November 18th. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky. During the 2021 session of the Texas Legislature, Senate Bill 8 was passed and subsequently signed into law by the governor. The law is a radical restriction of abortion, surely novel in its approach. Some would call it insidious. In the usual course of legal proceedings, it's the government's job to enforce the laws that it makes. However, in the case of SB 8, government officials are actually prohibited from taking enforcement actions. Instead, citizens are tacitly deputized to sue clinics and others who violate the law. And the law is sweeping in its scope. Despite the viability language of Roe v. Wade, SB 8 has changed the cutoff point, making abortion legal only prior to the detection of a heartbeat, which typically occurs about 6 weeks into a pregnancy, much earlier than viability. In July, the New York Times quoted Melissa Murray, a law professor at New York U, who noted, "If the barista at Starbucks overhears you talking about your abortion and it was performed after 6 weeks, that barista is authorized to sue the clinic where you obtained the abortion and to sue any other person who helped you, like the Uber driver who took you there." SB 8 provides a minimum award of $10,000 for each successful lawsuit. Stephen Vladek, faculty member at the UT Law School and frequent guest on this show, observes, "It's completely inverting the legal system. It says the state is not going to be the one to enforce this law. Your neighbors are." The Times labels this as a kind of hack of the legal system. They note that earlier this year, more than 370 Texas lawyers signed an open letter that called the law an unprecedented abuse of civil litigation and said it could have a destabilizing impact on the state's legal infrastructure. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Sarah Wheat, the Chief External Affairs Officer for Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas. Planned Parenthood creates healthier communities by providing comprehensive reproductive and related healthcare services, delivering science-based education programs, and serving as a strong advocate for reproductive justice in Texas. Michelle Manning Scott, Associate Producer of this program, is also with us. Thanks so much for joining us, Sarah. How are you doing today?
I'm good. It is always an honor and a pleasure to be here with you at KOOP. So thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you too. Maybe we could lead off with you just telling us a little about yourself and about Planned Parenthood. You know, I think because SB 8 is so much in the news these days, people's concept of Planned Parenthood might be a little narrower than the agency really is. I'll turn that over to you. Tell us a little about yourself and Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much. So I'm Sarah Wheat, and I've been here on the staff with the Plum Parent in Austin for quite a few years now. And my role is just working with the programs and staff teams and the work that we do outside of our health center. So I get to work real closely with partners across the Austin community here, which is very rewarding. And we're so fortunate to have such strong roots here in Austin. Plum Parenthood, we actually opened our first health center in Austin in 1937. So we've been part of this community for decades. And the services that we provide, they vary a little bit over time. Certainly they've changed since 1937. But honestly, the reason that Plum Parenthood was first created and first founded about 100 years ago in New York is because birth control was illegal. And at that time, women were really desperate to be able to plan and space their pregnancies. And birth control, all the forms of FDA-approved methods, including IUDs and implants and emergency contraception, that is still the primary leading healthcare service that we offer today. In Austin, we have three health centers. And one of our longtime health centers is under renovation for anybody who's driven by East 7th Street in Chicon. Our longtime health center there, thanks to donations from community members, we're undergoing a really much needed and overdue renovation of that health center and hope to open up early next year. But we also have a health center in North Austin, Central Austin, and South Austin. And we just recently expanded our hours so that we are open 7 days a week so that patients can access family planning services and the essential birth control services that I just mentioned.
You mentioned birth control and the age of Planned Parenthood. I think back to when I was in high school, the first time I bought a package of condoms in a pharmacy. I mean, it was kind of a stealth operation, you know?
Yeah. Well, and honestly, Bob, there's still a lot of stigma around sexual health today. Yeah. And that's really, you know, I think that's where Planned Parenthood shows up. And that's where we really continue to have such a strong positive response from our patients. A core of our commitment and our mission is that we provide respectful, non-judgmental healthcare. And particularly when it comes to sexual health, that is not something that is for sure when you're interacting with the healthcare system. And so today, you know, our health services have expanded. Transgender patients are an important patient population at our health centers. We provide gender-affirming hormone therapy. Another core and our second most common service after birth control that we provide is testing and treatment for sexually transmitted infections. Those are very common infections, and it's incredibly important that they be destigmatized and so that people will just seek routine testing. That way they're not carrying infection and having some potential negative outcomes without treatment, and they're also not transferring it unknowingly. So we do a lot of work to try to really destigmatize sexually transmitted infection testing and treatment. And that's actually our second most common healthcare service that we provide.
I was the board chair for AIDS Services of Austin about 15 years ago.
Wonderful.
And Planned Parenthood was always a great partner in the community. And HIV is still with us, but
absolutely.
It's a treatable disease, and it's certainly not what it was, 20, 30 years ago. I think Planned Parenthood can take some of the credit for that as well.
Well, and I was going to say, we're lucky to have AIDS Services of Austin. We're lucky to have the Kind Clinic. Like, there's so many really strong partners here. And I think that's especially important in Texas, where there is so much stigma around sexual health issues.
Right. Well, we were talking a little about the history of birth control there. And then I think the landmark decision that so many people cite came along in 1973, and that was Roe versus Wade. Could you speak to that a little?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this conversation is actually incredibly timely because there is an oral argument that'll be heard at the U.S. Supreme Court on December 1st. It's a case out of Mississippi, and it's widely recognized to be the most pivotal case involving abortion rights since Roe v. Wade. You know, backing up a little bit, Roe v. Wade has an important Texas connection. The case came from a patient out of Dallas, and Wade was actually the district attorney in Dallas. So Jane Roe was the anonymous name of the patient who was suing the Dallas attorney and his last name was Wade. So this is a Texas case. And of course, it was represented by Sarah Weddington, longtime Austin attorney, who I think she was age 23 when she stood up before the U.S. Supreme Court and argued this case successfully. And so since then, it has been widely understood and reaffirmed repeatedly through court rulings, you know, that Americans have this fundamental right to choose, you know, whether to carry their pregnancy to term and have the right to access an abortion. And we've never felt that right so threatened as we do right now because of Texas's extreme new abortion ban that is currently in place. And then also this Mississippi case that's going before the U.S. Supreme Court on December 1st.
So throughout the years since 1973, as you pointed out, there have been any number of decisions and it's been challenged so many times. I know that the Roman Catholic Church and other religious organizations have been opposed to abortion, but it's so highly charged and it's become such a single issue for voters, for example, for a certain segment of society. Do you have any sense about why that came to be or how we got to this place?
You know, that's a great question. And I think there's probably some faculty at UT and some researchers who could probably, you know, really dig in on that question. But clearly what we see is that reproductive rights, abortion, and honestly, just across the board, sexual health care has been so politicized.
Yeah.
And so we know in states like Texas, where primary elections determine so much, we know that what happens in those primary elections. So now you're talking about a smaller percent of the overall voting population, right? And what moves them to turn out that minority of voters, but passionate about banning abortion, you know, that's been proven to be weaponized really to enormous detriment here in Texas. So we just see it very much as having been politicized. And, you know, one thing I do just want to mention, Bob, we have gotten the question over the years, like, why doesn't Planned Parenthood just stop providing abortions, right? And then basically kind of won't all your troubles go away. But, you know, abortion is the sort of the headline, but everything within our mission is also under attack and has no support from these same politicians. So just general access to healthcare, you know, this is a state that refuses to expand Medicaid, right? So those same politicians vocalizing all their opposition to abortion, you know, they also refuse to expand Medicaid and provide more people with health insurance. The core, you know, the majority of patients that we serve, they are uninsured. And so, you know, that all these political dots connect. Sex ed, that is something that our organization, it's a core part of our mission. We think young people deserve honest, accurate information about their health and their bodies, and that they, you know, deserve to have that information and the skill building so they can make decisions. Sex ed is deeply politicized here in Texas.
Right.
So, you know, and we serve all patients. All patients are welcome. We don't require any kind of documentation or insurance status. You know, healthcare for patients without documentation is politicized. I mean, you can really just kind of connect across the dots. And so while abortion garners all the headlines, we see these policies affecting, honestly, every aspect of our mission. And I think saying it's only about abortion, I think that does a disservice to all the ways that our statewide electeds really undermine and undervalue healthcare as a broader concept.
Yeah, you mentioned sex ed, for example. Mm-hmm. Currently, the Republican primary is coming up. And as we're all painfully aware, these months prior to the actual primary become a race to the far right. So we see our governor right now embroiled in book banning, for example.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And most of those books, you know, the ones that are catching the headlines are often LGBTQ issues being addressed honestly and openly.
Right.
And with empathy. And then they're also often authored by people of color. I mean, we see that every time there's a list of books to ban, it is primarily authors, people of color, and LGBTQ issues being addressed.
I'm retired right now, but I tutor for AISD. I'm a I love doing that. My first job was teaching high school math, and I actually have a PhD in engineering. Right now, there continues to be, maybe there's always been, but there continues to be a really pressing need for math teachers. I spend about 15 hours a week at Navarro High School that used to be Lanier. I was in the school library yesterday. We've got a wonderful librarian there, and I was joking with her about the book ban. And she pointed me over in the direction of a display that she had put together.
Oh, really? Of some of the books that are...
She had gone through the library and pulled out all the books that were being contested.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And those are like amazing award-winning books, right? I mean, yeah. Incredible.
And there's a big sign on the top. These books are being investigated by your Texas state government.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing.
I'm still chuckling about that.
I love it. Well, thank you for what you do with AISD. I have two students and a AISD alumni. I have two students in AISD myself, my kids. So thank you.
Well, sure. It's been a real pleasure. Well, the other comment before we get into SB8, the other comment you made, you talked about minority. You know, I think this is a point that's lost among a lot of people, that right now in political polling, even in Texas here, conservative red state Texas, people favoring legalization of abortion are in the majority.
Right, right. And we've seen that those numbers have been pretty consistent. You know, if you track it back to when Roe v. Wade was first decided, I mean, really, the majority of Americans have consistently said that they recognize and they value that this should be a right that people have.
Well, let's move on to SB8 then. I think it's in the news just about every day, it seems like. Maybe you could give us a little background on that, Sarah.
So Texas enacted the most extreme abortion ban in the country on September 1st. And that's the SB8 that we're talking about. And it is the most extreme abortion ban enacted since abortion was recognized as a right in the Roe v. Wade U.S. Supreme Court decision. It's extreme in two significant ways. One is that it bans abortion at such an early stage of pregnancy. It's described as a 6-week abortion ban, but it's not even 6 weeks of pregnancy because you track a pregnancy based on your last menstrual period. So it's really, you're just potentially a couple weeks pregnant. And many people don't have regular cycles and so may not even realize that they're pregnant by the time this right has been taken away from them here in Texas. So the ban is getting enormous state, local, national, international attention because it's so extreme. No other state has gone this far. And no exceptions. No exceptions if that is a pregnancy due to rape or incest. And the health exceptions are so vaguely worded that it's really not clear that that would provide much assistance for many patients. So it's incredibly extreme in how many people it's impacting. And then secondly, this really stunning scheme of enactment. And that's why this case, you know, was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court just a couple weeks ago, whether this law is constitutional. Because as you all and your listeners are probably aware, there's no state entity responsible for enforcing this. It's up to individuals. They can live anywhere. They can live in Arkansas or they can live in Hawaii. Somebody anywhere can sue a person here in Texas and allege that they have had an abortion outside of the limits that SB8 enacts. And that person can be awarded a minimum of $10,000. And even if the case is completely found to be zero basis and totally not accurate and not true, that person's attorney's fees will be paid for. So, for example, somebody in Arkansas could sue one of our nurses here in our office and allege that our nurse provided an abortion outside of the SB8 abortion ban limits. Maybe they go to court, right? They go to court, it's heard, turns out it is not true. That individual will not be awarded $10,000 or more, but all of their attorney costs will be paid for by our nurse. and by our attorney. So what you've put out there is an incredibly intimidating and dangerous scheme, because you can imagine, so for Planned Parenthood, we provide abortions in some of our health centers. So here in Austin, one of our health centers provides medication and surgical abortions to patients. We are in compliance with this new law, which means we're having to tell at least half or more, we're still kind of tracking the numbers of patients who contact us, that we're not going to be able to help them out because of this law. We're having to notify them that they're going to have to leave the state if they want to access an abortion safely in a healthcare setting. So while we are in compliance, and yet we have this potential threat hanging over us where, you know, somebody could decide to file 20 fraudulent lawsuits against us. They will prove out to be fraudulent, and yet we now have to pay their attorney fees regardless. And that legal scheme and that incentivization for somebody to just, you know, madly file suits without much concern about whether they're going to be proven out or not, that's a huge financial risk that's put in place. And I don't want to cite the wrong number. I'm forgetting if it's 3 or 5 years, but basically, for example, you know, somebody who received an abortion last week here at our health center, you know, 2.5 years from now, we could be sued fraudulently, and yet we would be responsible to pay the legal fees for that person.
Wow. On the face of it, the first thing I think of is bounty hunting, you know? Mm-hmm. This is just so outrageous. A regular guest on this program is Stephen Vladek from mm-hmm. the UT Law School. He's been especially vocal on I was going to say the illegality. Well, we're, you know, I guess the jury's still out on that, but just mm-hmm. the words escape me here. The egregious.
Yeah.
I guess I wasn't aware that these lawsuits, the burden of these lawsuits rest entirely with the defendants.
Yes, yes. And typically, so this, and again, you know, the professor would have the expertise on this, and others who are, you know, constitutional law experts certainly right. would have deeper insights than I do. But what this flips from a legal standpoint is two things. One, standing. So somebody from Arkansas who has never met our patient could file a suit against our nurse, right? So typically you have to have some cause, you have to have been injured in some way. And yet this law totally removes that requirement. And then two, to make sure that our courts aren't flooded with frivolous lawsuits, typically whoever loses that case is on the hook for the legal fees. But this incentivizes anybody to jump in there. They don't have to have any cause, and they don't have to worry about paying legal fees because we're on the hook for those fees regardless of how the case proves out.
So you talked about the Mississippi case, and I knew that was on the Supreme Court docket. The Texas case was not originally on the docket. When it went into effect in September, there were requests to the U.S. Supreme Court to block it. They refused to do that. Mm-hmm. But subsequent to that, now they're including the Texas law along with the Mississippi law. Is that correct?
Great question. And it is a little confusing. So if Steve joins your show again, you can clarify with him. But yeah, basically, I mean, you know, one thing that's been incredibly concerning since September 1 is that this law is in effect. We have filed suit in state court, in federal court. We've appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And yet we've been stuck. And by we, I mean, every provider of abortion in the state has been forced into compliance. It's stunning that we're all forced in compliance with what is widely recognized to be an unconstitutional law. So here we are coming up on September, October, and we've had to be in compliance with this law. So yes, we appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. They denied our emergency appeal. What we've been asking is that this law be put on hold, you know, that there be an injunction in place until the court has a chance to fully hear out whether this case is constitutional. But the U.S. Supreme Court did take up our case. And of course, the U.S. Department of Justice intervened. So there's a U.S. v. Texas case that was heard in oral arguments over this SB 8. And so we've got now the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule on whether Texas is violating the Constitution with this law, and then also the Mississippi. And it's not clear to me whether they'll rule independently. We think that we will get a ruling on this Texas case, hopefully soon.
I'm just sighing all over the place here. Sorry.
No, it's pretty sobering. It's pretty sobering.
Yeah. Just thinking back, you know, you're talking a little about the statistics and clearly the number of abortions being performed here in Texas has taken a major hit. I just want to string together some of the things that you referred to. You said, for one thing, a lot of Planned Parenthood's clients are low income. These mm-hmm. are people who can't afford to see a gynecologist, for example, that regularly rely on Planned Parenthood or community clinics, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think of someone in that situation who now finds herself pregnant and is so poor and so unable to have a child, to raise a child at this point mm-hmm. in her life. Mm-hmm. You know, what are her options? She can leave the state, you know, well, that's not cheap either. You know, and we're talking about people, many of whom are likely to be on Medicaid anyway, if they even got in there. I mean, given that mm-hmm. we haven't expanded Medicaid. And so what are we doing? We're creating more poverty. We're creating more misery with all this.
Mm-hmm. I want to make sure to lift up the impact of what we've seen under this abortion ban. And really, you know, it's hard to overstate how devastating it's been for every single patient that we see. And it has such a disparate impact. You know, somebody with resources and with funds and family support and no barriers, yes, they will fly to Los Angeles and they'll access that appointment that they need there. But for the vast majority of patients that we see, it is not an option. And it's putting so much about their life and even their health at risk.
We're speaking with Sarah Wheat from Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on November 18th. Our guest this evening is Sarah Wheat, the Chief External Affairs Officer for Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas. Let's pick up where we left off.
One of our very first patients after the law took effect is a brand new immigrant here from Afghanistan. She does not speak English. Through a translator, we had to explain to her this new law that's in place. She was here with her husband and young children, and we had to explain to her that she was 2 days too late, right? So we're talking just 48 hours. Previously, we would have been able to provide this care. Here we are in our health center where we have trained professionals who are skilled, compassionate, and able to provide these services. And yet the governor is sitting right there between us and that patient. We cannot provide her the care she needs. And what we can only tell her is, you know, what her options are, which are to leave the state. Fortunately, you know, there's been so much concern over these patients that there's funding available. And important organizations like the Lilith Fund and T Fund, you know, are doing great work to help patients who are having to travel. But for this patient, like that is not even for so many reasons, like that's just not a factor. She was physically exhausted, emotionally exhausted, and just really not wanting to carry this pregnancy to term. But based on everything she shared in that appointment, that is probably the case. We had another patient who her last pregnancy was very risky for her health. She has health conditions that really put her at risk for pregnancy. That patient was about 3 days outside of the ban. And so now she is planning to carry that pregnancy forward. And we certainly hope she's going to have a healthy pregnancy, but there's nothing the state is doing to support her in any way. We have one of the worst maternal mortality rates here in Texas. So, you know, these are patients, they're not getting help with their pregnancy. They're not getting help preventing their pregnancy because the family planning system here has been dismantled by the legislature. And so, you know, it really exposes, I think, you know, just the total disregard that these policies have for the patients that we see.
What's happened with oral medications? We used to call it the morning after pill.
Yeah, emergency contraception. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did that take a hit too? Or?
So, I mean, that is actually, you know, that is something that's fortunately widely available. We had politicians who worked really hard to try to prevent that from going over the counter, but a lot of hard work went into making sure that was. So emergency contraception, it's sometimes called Plan B, sometimes called, it used to be called the morning after pill, but it's effective for up to 5 days after an unintended pregnancy. So we kind of moved away from calling it morning after because we want to make sure people know it can be 2 mornings after and you can still take that and it's going to be highly effective at preventing a pregnancy. So the good news is emergency contraception is available over the counter in pharmacies across the state. So sometimes that's just an awareness issue, making sure people know it's out there. That is something, again, we've had so many folks so concerned about what's going to happen to our patients because of this new law and patients across the state. So we actually have these kits that we're now offering to every patient who comes into our health center. And it's got emergency contraception in it. It has condoms. It has an early detection home pregnancy test, and it has information about the new abortion law. And so we're just offering these to every single patient when they come into our health centers and urging them to keep that in their medicine cabinet, keep it handy, because with, you know, so much of the decision-making taken away from our patients when it comes to accessing an abortion, this is just one thing we're trying to put into the hands of as many patients as we can.
Sure.
You know, that is progress though. I mean, emergency contraception, the fact that, you know, you can walk into a CVS or, you know, Walmart and access those resources up to 5 days after unprotected sex. And so fortunately, that is a tool people can access. You know, there's all sorts of reasons why somebody seeks an abortion. Mm-hmm. And it's not always due to an unintended pregnancy, although that is the leading factor.
Yeah, well, that's good to know. That was going to be one of my questions. Is there any further, I mean, is that kind of what Planned Parenthood at this moment is kind of putting all of their eggs in their basket towards as far as funding and things? Is like, well, if we can't do the abortions, we're going to put a lot of resources into making sure people know that this pill is out there in the meantime.
Yeah.
And then you say you give the kits to anybody who walks in, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you just do that regardless. And is that something that you actually offer for people to just walk in off the street and say, I need this?
Yeah.
And so can't go to a CVS because I can't afford it.
Yeah. Thank you. Those are super great questions. Yes. I mean, in terms of the abortion ban, like we're all in whatever we can do. So, you know, like I said, we have filed in state court, we have filed in federal court, and we know how important it is that this ban be heard in a court that can rule that it's unconstitutional. So goal one is to get this law overturned so our patients can again access abortion. But number two is just trying to raise awareness, make sure folks know what's at risk if they are seeking abortion, that their options have really been limited. And so this emergency contraception that we're distributing, absolutely, we don't want cost to be a barrier. Anybody can come in to our health centers and access one. We're also just putting the final plans in place, but we're going to begin to also be able to provide them out in the community. So we'll be reaching out to longtime partners. There's a lot of nonprofits and organizations that we've worked with in different capacities over the years. And so we'll be reaching out to them and seeing if they have clients who might benefit from these. And we actually have the goal of distributing 22,000 of these where needed in the coming months. So that's a second project that we're doing. And then, as I mentioned, we just added Saturday and Sunday hours at one of our health center so that 7 days a week, a patient can access an appointment for all the services that we provide, but particularly thinking about birth control and not wanting somebody to not be able to access birth control if they need it. Because there are so many barriers to birth control. I think that's surprising to people. They assume it's just widely readily available. But particularly, you know, if you're uninsured and if cost is a consideration, there can be barriers to accessing the birth control method, particularly if it's the birth control method a patient would like to choose. If they want an IUD or implant or the patch or the ring or the shot, we want to make sure they have a method that fits their health and their goals. And so we have expanded. So we're open 9 to 5 on Saturdays and Sundays now to make those appointments more available.
I'm curious also to know if there's ever been or talk about partnering with like mainstream sources of healthcare information. I'm thinking in terms of like CVS and Walgreens, how they're doing with the COVID. If there's any way of like getting together with them to like have an avenue of, you know, promoting that there are options beyond what you might think as far as birth control and far as like the abortion access pill, you know, the pills and things like that.
That's a great question. And I think one thing we do have now that thankfully is such an opportunity to educate people and connect with people is everything we can offer online and through apps, right? So we have an app, it's called Planned Parenthood Direct, PP Direct. But somebody can just download that app and they can actually order like birth control delivered to their local pharmacy or their home, typically within 24 hours to 48 hours. So that's just another resource and tool out there. So, you know, I think we just try to look at where are there opportunities to connect openly and freely with people and make sure they can access this healthcare and the information they need.
All of this discussion is encouraging. I guess where I was going in my mind is trying to think of what would the world look like if we did have to turn the clock back to 1973, you know? Uh-huh. There's so many old stories about coat hangers and back alley and that sort of thing. I mean, at least these days we do have some other options or we've got other resources that didn't exist in 1973, I guess. Have you given any thought to that at all? Or is that too soon to be thinking in terms?
No. I think that's a really important question, Bob. And I think there's kind of two answers to that. One, in some ways, honestly, we feel like that day is already here. You know, just the restrictions that are in place are significant. Even before this latest, you know, abortion ban that bans at approximately 6 weeks. I mean, you know, we already have so many layers that the state has put in place, right? So, you know, there's a waiting period, there's information that patients have to be shared, you know, patients are forced to have a sonogram, and they're forced for our doctor to have to describe the sonogram and play any audio that's available from the sonogram and read a script about all the health risks of an abortion. And, you know, if they're seeking a medication abortion, they're mandated a certain number of appointments, and it has to be the same doctor who provides the sonogram. And then when they come back 24 hours or longer later, it has to be that same doctor who provides that abortion. And so we have a lot of barriers in place already. And again, when you think of the most vulnerable patients, you know, who may not have ready access to transportation or time off work, most women seeking an abortion already have a child. So who's taking care of the children? How are they getting time off work? How are they getting, you know, borrow their sister's car to get here? I mean, so in some ways, particularly for the most marginalized community members, like that day is here. And then also because we've had to be in compliance with this law since September 1, I mean, we have patients. I just saw a report from the Guttmacher Institute. I think Texans have shown up in 12 different states since September 1 seeking abortions. Patients are already having to scramble to, you know, we had one patient, she was on her way to Oklahoma and her car broke down and called our patient navigator for help. What could she do, you know, and what would happen next? You know, we have patients who are in domestic violence situations. Mm-hmm. They feel trapped if they have to carry this pregnancy through. And yet for them to leave the state, like if they're coming here to our health center, you know, in town where they live, they potentially can do that and get away from their partner, but they can't get away for a day and a half to go to New Mexico or Louisiana or Colorado without their partner. And so now they're at risk and maybe potentially trapped in this ongoing intimate partner violence situation. So there's just a lot of devastating barriers already in place. And so I think on some level, we feel like we're already seeing what that looks like. And for many of our patients, you know, that Roe v. Wade really doesn't mean much when you can't access an abortion.
We're running out of time here. Did we miss anything that you wanted to cover?
No, I think, you know, what I do want to say is we have seen incredible support. You know, I think that's one thing. For all the challenges that we face due to these statewide politicians who create all these barriers, you know, we've seen incredible support from the community. We've had so many community members reaching out and offering to provide transportation, provide support, you know, help purchase these kits that we can give away, like just so many different ways that the community has shown up and spoken out. Mm-hmm. You know, hundreds of folks were out of the Capitol earlier this month, October. Sorry, it's been a little bit of a blur, the timeline. But we, you know, had hundreds come up and, step out and show up demanding that this law be overturned. So, you know, I think we don't move forward without folks speaking up. And so I think sometimes it can feel a little bit overwhelming, like right now, because this law is so extreme. But that's honestly when we need to speak up the most. Like that's when we most need people to be active, stay in the game, speak up, be loud. And we've got to hang in there together and make this better, because we know that folks across the state deserve access to all the healthcare that they need, including abortion. And it's up to all of us to help be voices.
Michelle, anything to add?
No, other than my standard, is there a website or other ways to communicate with Planned Parenthood if you want to get involved in some way?
Yeah, sure. So our website is ppgreatertx.org. So we're Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas. So it's ppgreatertx.org. And definitely lots of ways that folks can get involved and be supportive. And in fact, they really do. We're so grateful to be part of the Austin community, and we feel so supported by community members. So thank you for inviting me to join you all today.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been front and center in the news now for months, and it's a real honor and a privilege to be speaking with someone like you, Sarah, who's on the front lines. So we're most grateful for all of your efforts.
Of course. So glad to be with you both, and I'm a big KOOP fan, so thank you.
Okay. Well, once again, it's Friday afternoon and time to hear from Austin Sanders, staff writer at the Austin Chronicle. How you doing, Austin?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Okay. So a couple stories this week about violence prevention. It sounds like one involved the city council and some new marshal office, I guess. But the other one I'm more interested in is what the DA is doing with guns these days. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Travis County District Attorney Jose Garza announced his office was engaging in a new kind of community-wide violence prevention plan aimed at trying to reduce the increased levels of gun violence Austin and the Travis County community have experienced in the past 2 years. Part of this is going to be using powers within the district attorney's office. This is, you know, the top law enforcement entity in the county. So there's quite a bit of power that they have. Most of it is in choosing what cases they want to try and which they don't. Of course, that's not, you know, the most helpful tool when trying to prevent violence. One thing that they will be trying to do is implement what are called prosecutor-led gun diversion programs. And what diversion programs are, when someone is arrested and charged with a crime, rather than sentencing them to prison or keeping them in jail for a long time, prosecutors can divert them to kind of rehabilitative programs, right? If it's a drug charge someone has brought in, maybe they'll be diverted to a substance use therapy program, something like that. And so the idea with the gun diversion programs is to take people who may be brought in on even just a gun possession charge, not necessarily an assault with a deadly weapon charge, but some gun-related charge, and kind of screen out people who may be high risk for committing violence and divert them to therapy, anger management, life skills services that can kind of help them cope with the underlying causes of violence and crime rather than just, you know, locking them in prison for, you know, a period of time where, of course, they are eventually going to get out. And what we know is when someone is in prison, they're much more likely to recidivate when they are released from incarceration, right? So this is kind of the general philosophy of this violence prevention plan, is to try to take steps other than sentencing people to prison to help reduce crime. Some of the other things the DA's office is doing, they're partnering with researchers at Arizona State University and Johns Hopkins University to kind of renew research that these two universities did in the 90s that helped inform national legislation on intimate partner violence, you know, domestic violence policies, to kind of get a better understanding of the role firearms play in this type of violence. You know, as we talked on your show before, in Austin, Travis County, and really the whole country, a great deal of the gun violence and homicides that occur in America are a result of domestic violence. You know, people who know each other having easy access to firearms and using them to shoot and sometimes kill each other. And so this research is going to try and help Travis County and Austin Police Department identify abusive relationships where the dynamics could be escalating toward violence and intervene early to try and prevent those violent acts from occurring. The county is also working on, the DA's office is working on a countywide firearm surrender protocol. This is when someone gets any kind of criminal violation or sentence that prohibits them from possessing firearms. There's really no protocol right now for someone to surrender that firearm. So the DA's office is working on that. They've established a victim services division. They're going to work on a safe gun storage campaign to kind of help people understand how to keep their firearms locked up, to kind of make it more difficult to use them in a heat of the moment situation. So those are the kinds of things that the DA's office itself is taking on. But one thing that the plan acknowledges is that this has to be a community-wide effort. Law enforcement, the criminal justice system can only do so much. So to that end, they partnered with a researcher, a research fellow at the University of Chicago, Dr. Chico Tillman, to kind of explore other solutions. And Dr. Tillman is actually working with the city of Austin's Office of Violence Prevention on similar measures, ways that the city and the county and the community at large can kind of intervene in places where violence is most likely to occur to kind of prevent violence from happening, right? And this is really the kind of key to this approach, is in addressing violence as a public health issue, not just as a public safety issue, right? The idea is that violence itself, like a virus, is contagious. And places where violence occurs more frequently, part of that is because violence is occurring in those areas. And so by addressing poverty, educational levels, different things of this nature, housing, what's known as the social determinants of health, the idea is to address these issues and thereby reduce the amount of violence in these communities.
I don't suppose in the state of Texas there's any hope for restricting the sale of guns or the number of guns out on the street, huh?
It seems unlikely. Yeah. As you know, any Texan can carry a handgun without a permit, thanks to legislation passed this past session. So firearms are going to be even more prevalent than they have been in the past. There were record gun sales all across the country and in Texas during the pandemic. So these kinds of measures that are aimed at preventing violence rather than just responding to it are going to be really critical.
Well, on that other story, I understand that there was an item on the city council docket yesterday to create a marshal office. Do I have that right?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Let me just say up front, the item was postponed until January because council members and criminal justice advocates alike were kind of taken off guard by this item, which would essentially establish an entirely new law enforcement agency in Austin. Austin did have a marshal's office from 1987 till about 2006. They were managed by the law department. They provided security at the municipal court, the airport, parks, places like that. But that was all consolidated under APD in 2008. But this item would basically undo that and recreate the marshal's office, basically, at a cost of about $2.8 million to get the new agency launched. And the purpose that city staff says is to provide security at the municipal court. This is the city of Austin court where a lot of minor violations are held, traffic violations, city ordinance violations, a lot of the public camping when people experiencing homelessness are arrested or ticketed for public camping. These cases are heard in the municipal court.
Well, it sounds like this is almost like an end run around the people who are interested in kind of holding the line against APD. I mean, is that unfair to look at it that way?
No, I would definitely say that's how the criminal justice advocates felt, you know, especially because staff, city staff, kind of tried to characterize this item as a continuation of the reimagining public safety effort, because it wouldn't be APD, the Austin Police Department, carrying out this law enforcement function. It would be this new entity. But advocates pointed out, you know, as Chris Harris, as your listeners will be familiar with, the way he put it to me is, this is just trading cops for cops, right? It's APD officers and a private security firm currently provide security at the municipal court. But basically, this would just be replacing them with new cops, a marshal and marshal's deputies to carry out these kind of similar functions. Municipal court staff say this is badly needed. You know, for most of the pandemic, the court has been operating virtually, but they are opening back up to in-person cases. You know, in January, they're expected to open even more of their dockets in person. I mean, they're saying security is a concern. One of the staffers told me that the court has seen a 75% reduction in the number of cases, but a 275% increase in security incidents. And I think we should be careful about what constitutes a security incident. This is something that advocates, especially those at the Fair Defense Project, they're a law firm that specializes in indigent defense, right? They really represent defendants who are, you know, lower income and may not have the means to afford attorneys. They have a lot of cases that go before the municipal court. And, you know, some of the people that go may have underlying issues and a not so positive view of the justice system that may make them more prone to causing a quote unquote security incident. And for the advocates, it's, do we want to manage that problem with police? Or is the purpose of the reimagining public safety effort to move away from that model, to find different ways of interacting with people who historically have had negative relationships with law enforcement, with the court system, to find new ways of making these kinds of environments safe for staff and the people interacting with the justice system alike?
Well, it sounds like people need to bring themselves up to speed, I guess, on the purpose of all this, and it'll be reconsidered again in a couple months then, huh?
Right, right. Yeah, January. You know, this is a point of concern for advocates. It was postponed to January 27th, the item. Of course, you know, there's a lot of holidays in between now and then, so there's a fear that staff and community members won't have enough time to kind of meaningfully engage on what security at the municipal court could look like. But council is committed to doing that work. Staff seems to be on the same page. So I think there's hope that things will work out.
Well, it's a busy Friday afternoon for you. I understand you've got some more interviews to do here, so we'll keep it short today. Really appreciate your update, as we do every week, and want to wish you and your family a very happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you, Bob. Thanks again for squeezing me in, and I hope you and your listeners all have a happy holiday.
We're always grateful for everything that you share with us. So take care.
You too. Thanks.
Up next here on co-op.org and on the 91.7 HD3 channel, stay tuned for Youth Spin. That's all from us this evening. Have a happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and stay safe.